Right now, a little breeze from the west at 5, a sunny blue sky, 25 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We begin today's program with a program that decidedly takes me out of my wheelhouse, as they say, out of my area of sort of personal experience and expertise, because we're going to be talking for the next few minutes about, of all things, tequila, and about a really fascinating new book called A Field Guide to Tequila, what it is, where it's from, and how to taste it. It is a really lovingly crafted book by one Clayton Check, who essentially is a full-time tequila expert, leading tequila tours and writing extensively and speaking extensively about this drink and the fascinating process by which it is made. And his book is designed with regular folks in mind. And it is a really illuminating guide to tequila, what it is, and everything about it. It's beautifully put together, published by Artisan. And Clayton Check, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Happy to be here.
So you talk in the preface of your book about your own personal relationship with tequila. And at one point you say, I am deeply grateful to tequila because you've met a lot of great people and experienced a lot of fun things. But you go on to say, but it wasn't always like this. Like many people, I got off on the wrong foot with tequila. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, hopefully I won't share too much about that, but it's easy to do. A lot of listeners, I think, will probably know through a combination of maybe making the wrong choices about the quality of the tequila we consume, and a sort of cultural expectation many of us grow up with, that if it's time for tequila, it's time to overconsume. Or relatedly, some people turn to tequila maybe at the end of the night and drinking other things and then blame the tequila instead of the sheer volume of everything else. So through all those combinations, there's a lot of ways that people in the U.S. Tend to abuse tequila and get turned off from it. But we've really, really seen a cultural shift occur in the 15 years I've been involved with this, which I'm happy to play a small role in, teaching people that, like with any other product, there's different levels of quality in tequila, and that it's a drink that if you treat it with respect, will treat you with respect. And it only took me 3 tries at different times in my life to get it right.
You tell a nice story about the wedding of a dear friend in Texas back, I think it was 2006, where you politely declined, having some unpleasant memories of the last time you consumed tequila, and they were gently insistent, and you're really glad that they were, because it sounds like that kind of transformed your understanding of this drink.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Mexican-American wedding, like you said, dear friends of mine, and my friend's brothers, the bride's brothers, were like, hey, buddy, with all due respect, you're at our sister's wedding in San Antonio. You're not going to get out of here without sharing some tequila with us. And so having it in that cultural context where people are using it kind of, as a way to bring folks together to celebrate a special event and to meet new friends and introduce them to old friends, is really what tequila has been about for hundreds of years. And so to appreciate it in that context really prepped me to move to Mexico, because I was literally on my way to move to Mexico to teach English and stop through for the wedding. So they did a very, very good job of preparing me for the next several years of my life and what turned out to be a career change and a real change in my life, which, again, I'm very grateful to them and everybody else in Mexico that opened these doors for me.
It sounds like your book is well-timed in that a little later in the preface you write, tequila has grown and evolved quite a lot, even in the short amount of time I have known it. Can you give us at least kind of a capsule summary of what you are talking about? Because I think most of us don't think of something changing.
Yeah, I would say the main change, and this is related to what I think is one of the most important things folks can know about tequila, which is that there are two categories of tequila. And the one that I would recommend folks veer towards is 100% agave tequila. And that means that all of the alcohol in that beverage came from sugars from the blue agave, and there's no external sugar sources, say from processed table sugar or corn syrup or things like that. So we tend to prefer these 100% agave tequilas, and that's one of the two categories. And relatively recently, in the last couple of decades, is when the United States really started to understand that difference and embrace 100% agave tequila. And just a few years ago, during my career is when the U.S. sales of 100% agave tequilas overtook the other category of tequila. And I think that was really a moment. And a lot of this was driven by the craft cocktail movement and serious bartenders taking their craft seriously and saying, you know, just because we're mixing this with citrus and with some kind of sweetener doesn't mean the base spirit shouldn't be very high quality. And so those two things, I think, have really come together to give tequila sort of the greater appreciation and status that it's enjoying today, which I think it certainly deserves. Hmm.
We need to take a few minutes to talk about the plant from which tequila is derived, namely the agave, A-G-A-V-E. And you say this plant, which is a succulent, is kind of a big deal. In fact, a really big deal. In fact, it's safe to say that the agave has importance that surpasses just tequila, but has been a source of sustenance in all kinds of amazing ways. Tell our listeners a little more about this incredible plant and what makes it also so fascinating.
Well, one thing I would say is, I don't know the age of your listeners. They might be a little younger or a little older than me, but most of us who grew up in the U.S. at some point learned something about the significance of the buffalo, the material and symbolic significance of the buffalo for, Native people in the plains areas and in what's now the Midwest, and how much of their basic needs were taken care of by this one creature. The agave played a somewhat similar role for Mesoamerican peoples well before the arrival of Europeans, and even well before folks domesticated corn. So back when corn was still just a wavy grass whose seeds you could hardly see, folks over 10,000 years ago in Mexico were already cooking and consuming the heart of the agave plants as one of their major sources of nutrients and energy, which allowed them to spread all throughout what is now Mexico. And they would also use different varieties of agaves. There are about 200 varieties of agaves, most of which are found only in Mexico. And some of them will provide them with building materials. Some of them will provide them with ropes, shoes, clothing, medicine, vinegar, and eventually a fermented alcoholic beverage, which is in some ways a precursor to the later distilled beverages like tequila. So these plants have been a really central part to the cultures of Mesoamerica for thousands and thousands of years. And the plant, and the blue agave in particular, has been its own distinct species for about 14 million years. So in that time, it's really evolved to the harsh and dry environments found throughout Mexico and wastes no time in hoarding energy from the sun and using very, very little water to create this astounding amount of energy in a plant. And if you think about, making a spirit from grain, it takes, truckloads and truckloads of corn or grain to make whiskey. Whereas with the agave, you get multiple bottles from a single plant. And that's because unlike a grain or a fruit, which is an annual, it's going to take between 5 and 8 years for each one of these plants to reach the maturity needed to make a good tequila.
And I love the poetic way in which you describe the life cycle of the agave. You write, the agave's life cycle is a chain of dramatic and breathtaking events. Growing agaves clone themselves dozens of times while living off sunlight, minerals in the soil, and sparse annual rainfall. After a few years of aggressively hoarding solar energy in the form of complex carbohydrate chains, they propel all of that energy and matter upward in the form of a spectacular flower stalk. Once they've exhausted all their stored energy in this Herculean reproductive effort, they die heroically, enriching the soil that will give rise to a new generation of agave. So we learned so much about the process by which tequila is made from agave, and it is a long and interesting process. Let's talk for a moment about what tequila tastes like. I mean, how it compares to other liquors with which some of us might be a lot more familiar. Or is it so unique that it's difficult to compare it?
Some versions of it are a little bit more difficult to compare because of the unique character of the agave as compared to fruits or grains that most of us are familiar with from cuisine and, you know, snacks and just a general part of our diet and being staple foods. However, with tequila, within that one category that I like to focus on of 100% agave tequila, we have five classes of tequila, and those are defined by how much contact they've had with oak barrels or oak recipients, if at all. And for a lot of folks coming from, I've had the pleasure of visiting Milwaukee in that region, and I know there's a great brandy tradition there, for example. And so if someone's coming, say, from the South and is familiar with bourbon, or they're coming, say, from Wisconsin and are familiar with French-style brandies, the aged tequilas that have spent more time in oak barrels, like a whiskey has or like a brandy has, are going to have a lot of familiar aromas and flavors that we get from that barrel and are generally going to be kind of more gentle and welcoming entry points for a North American drinker. So those classes of tequilas are called reposados, which is just a fancy old-timey word for rested in Spanish. And those have been in oak for a minimum of 2 months. And at a minimum of 1 year in a smaller barrel, it becomes called an añejo, which just means 1 year old. And after 3 years, it's an extra añejo. And there's a corresponding rise in price as you go through those classes because, just like in whiskey and brandy, some of the product is lost to the barrel, what was called the angel's share. So that corresponding raise in price might be a limit for some people. They might not want to invest in an extra añejo the first time they're trying to get serious about tequila. But if they're brandy drinkers or whiskey drinkers, I might start towards that end. But the real essence of tequila is in the blanco or the silver, which is where the plant really expresses itself, which is where the processes of fermentation and distillation really express themselves. And I would say, since most folks listening to this probably haven't tried cooked agave, we have something very close in our cuisine, which is a yam or a sweet potato. If you think about Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner and you're cooking those yams or sweet potatoes in your oven, and if you let them cook a little, I like it when they get like this. To some people, it's a little too long. But when it starts to weep that syrup out of the side and you get that nice caramelized sweet syrup, that's the closest thing that probably everybody listening to this has tried that is similar to the nature of the blue agave. And so when you're sipping an unaged silver tequila, you want to kind of be searching in there for those aromas that might remind you of a baked yam or a sweet potato.
Very good. So you write in the preface, there's just something about a tequila buzz that seems brighter and happier than other experiences. And we learn more and more about tequila in your wonderful book called A Field Guide to Tequila, What It Is, Where It's From, and How to Taste It, published by Artisan, full of wonderful charts and photographs. The author, Clayton Check. Clayton Check, thank you so much for this time, and thank you for giving the world this really intriguing and entertaining book.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. Well, we are exploring the stomach today on this portion of The Morning Show. Maybe more specifically, what we put in our stomachs and the history of how Americans in particular have looked at the whole matter of food and eating and appetite and dieting and so on. And one of the most interesting insights of this book called A Short History of the American Stomach is of how the more things change, the more they stay the same. And so much of what we see all around us in American society, in contemporary American society, isn't all that new, even when it comes to matters like fad diets and vegetarianism and all kinds of other matters related to what we eat and how we eat and how we think of this whole part of our lives and how surprisingly central it is to our lives as Americans. The author of this very thought-provoking book is Frederick Kaufman, a professor of English at the City University of New York and CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism. He has written about American food in other places, and this book is published by Harcourt, again called A Short History of the American Stomach. Frederick Kaufman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, hello, how are you?
Fine, and I'm looking forward to this conversation very much. So, first of all, how do we pronounce this word, which I have never, ever seen before in my life, spelled G-A-S-T-R-O-S-O-P-H-Y? I guess I could have looked it up in the dictionary.
Well, you know, I don't think it is in any dictionary, that word. I found it in a 19th century diet book, and I think that the pronunciation is gastrosophist. And the gastrosophist was the 19th century name for the diet guru. Instead of a philosopher, we had gastrosophers.
Hmm. Yeah, you call that the name for the physiological, psychological, and philosophical study of the stomach. And you say that in some respects, the study of that reached its zenith, you say, in early 19th century America. So in other words, long before we would ever have imagined it to be so, Americans were intensely interested in these same topics which interest us so much today.
It goes all the way back to the Puritans, and it does reach a huge boiling point in the Jacksonian period and the period right before the Civil War, all the way through the 19th century. The diet book and the diet guru, these are huge publishing phenomena, very similar as they are today.
Mm. Tell our listeners the interesting story you tell at the very beginning of the book of what in some ways almost seems like a genesis or one of the genesis of this particular book when you were almost kind of desperately pitching a magazine proposal to Harper's Magazine.
Well, I was at a party and I ran into Lewis Lapham, who was then the editor-in-chief. And I had never written for Harper's Magazine before, and I thought, here's my opportunity. And I started pitching to him the idea of American gastrosophy, these great philosophers of the 19th century. And, of course, he gave me this completely blank look, like, what do I care about indigestion in the Jacksonian period? And then something clicked, and I realized this is the exact same thing going on 150 years ago as it is today. And so I said to Lewis Lapham, I'd like to compare the diet book mania today to the diet book mania 150 years ago. And that got his attention, and I sold him the piece, and since then I've written a lot for Harper's and became a contributing editor.
Right. And what you say is that as you began studying this, something you suspected maybe was true, in fact, turned out to be true, namely, the more I learned, the more convinced I became that absolutely nothing had changed.
That's right. That's right. And I kept on going farther and farther back, trying to figure out how this country was completely obsessed with what it would eat, what it wouldn't eat, why we're so weird about our food choices, why anorexia is this huge, threatening problem, why obesity is constantly in the news, why people are screaming and yelling about soda in the schools and our toxic food environment and genetically modified organisms, and why there's all these foodies in this country and chow hounds and competitive eating. What is this all about?
Hmm. You say the United States was and remains one of the most gut-centric and gut-phobic societies in the history of human civilization.
Absolutely.
That's quite a dramatic statement you're making there. I mean, how much do you literally mean that to be true? I mean, because, of course, everybody eats, and everybody, to some extent at least, thinks a little bit about food. But something leads you to say that Americans take this so much further than anyone else does or ever has?
Well, everything that lives eats. And, of course, we all know the French are obsessed with their food, and we all know that the Chinese are obsessed with their food, and we have these incredible cuisines from these different cultures. America is different, though. We do not have a cuisine that goes all the way back. Sure, we've got regional cuisines, and we have traditional foods, but really everybody here came from somewhere else. And part of this syndrome of American eating comes from those times 400 years ago when the Dutch first arrived and the Puritans first arrived. Certain things happened in this country which made us more obsessed and more focused on our stomach than any other country. Perhaps it was part of the physical geography, perhaps was part of a whole new world of food that hope opened up. And another big part of it is the Puritan emphasis on our relationship to God through our stomach.
Hmm. Yeah, you say this laid the groundwork by injecting moral content into everything we would or would not eat. I mean, that it was not only a choice based on simple preferences and desires and taste, but these were moral decisions that people were making about what to take into their bodies.
Yeah, the great Puritan divine, Cotton Mather, believed that his soul was the great digester. You have to realize that the science of that time, the psychology of that time, the medicine of that time, the physiology of that time was all stomach-based. The stomach was the center of the medical universe to the Puritans, and therefore they could understand if they had indigestion or if they were doing well with their stomach that either God was with them or Satan was inside of them. Of course, if they had a horrible stomach ache, if their bowels were out of order, and of course the bowels were the seat of sympathy back then. If you had sympathy for somebody else, you had bowels for them. That's what they would say. Love your neighbor, love their bowels. And if there was something wrong with your own stomach, you, of course, had to get rid of whatever it was that was inside that stomach. And, of course, there were many ways.
Hmm. You know, this is interesting because I have a couple of different friends who, because of actually other physical problems, serious physical problems, have taken on, among other symptoms, problems related to the stomach or the intestines or the elimination of food, that kind of thing. And it has been tremendously difficult for them, and in some ways surprisingly so. I mean, that they never would have guessed before they began suffering difficulty that it would be such a profound kind of difficulty. I mean, it's almost as though we don't realize until something goes wrong just how central this all is to our physical lives.
That's absolutely right, because the stomach is part of the kind of the center of our involuntary nervous system. We have the smooth nerve muscles are the ones that we can't really feel. Like we hurt our finger, we knock our head. That's our central nervous system. We feel it. And that's the brain and the head, which is the brain and the head and the spinal cord. It turns out there is a brain in the gut. There are many scientific theories. It actually began about a little more than 100 years ago by a scientist in this country, that the brain and the gut, in other words, the neurons surrounding the stomach and the nervous tissue around it, there are actually more neurons there than there are in the brain and the head and the spinal cord. So therefore, when you have butterflies in your stomach, when you have a gut reaction, you're actually thinking with your brain and the gut. And what I've been trying to propose is that Americans actually spend more of their time thinking with their brain in the gut than with their brain in the head, and that perhaps this might explain some of our the vicissitudes of our political and economic difficulties right now.
We're speaking with Frederick Kaufman, and we're talking about his book called A Short History of the American Stomach. Tell us just briefly, when one sets about to study something like this, where you go, and where did you find maybe the most interesting treasure troves of information to help us understand how early Americans thought about food and their stomachs?
I ended up reading everything I could get my hands on, early newspapers, diaries, and of course I found a underground treasure trove in medical libraries. I would find these old, outdated medical books, and I realized that, of course, medicine changes constantly, and that the medicine of 200 or 300 years ago, people have just completely forgotten about. Oh, it's no longer true. We don't need it anymore. We're on to something next. However, that gave me this indication of how it was people were thinking about their own bodies. The way you think about your medicine is the way you think about how your body works. And, of course, your idea about how your own body works really informs your idea about the entire world and the entire universe, the way you understand how your body works. And through those medical texts, which are almost exclusively about the stomach, I was able to begin to uncover some of this history.
Hmm. I know that you also explored all kinds of cookbooks, old and new. I mean, you talk about some of the very first cookbooks that were produced in North America. Tell our listeners, more related to the current day, what happened when you went into your local Borders bookstore and inquired about cookbooks.
I really wanted to understand the cookbook and the diet book landscape. And so, in fact, one of the things I did is I went to my local Borders and I said, can you give me a printout of all the diet books you're selling? And the clerk looked at me and said, okay. And about 20 minutes later, the printer was still going. I had over 700 diet books that I realized I'm going to have to do some heavy reading here.
You said perhaps no such textual purge had ever occurred in the history of bookstores or something like that.
and of course, I started reading them, and I realized that they're very similar in so many ways to the diet books and the diet gurus, as I said before, of 150 years ago. This has been a strong publishing sector for hundreds of years in our country.
Hmm. One thing that, of course, is a more unique phenomenon in all of this is the explosion of material that we see on television, although it's obviously an outgrowth of the very same fascination. But of course, this is a new kind of media that makes this even more accessible to all of us, particularly from 1993 on, which you call sort of the beginning of a new era in all of this. Explain to our listeners what happened in 1993 and thereafter.
Well, in 1993, we have the creation of the Food Network, and the Food Network, as we all know, is the dominant force in food television. And I, my editor was very interested in food media, and she asked me, her name is Andrea Schultz, she asked me if I could spend some time looking at the Food Network and talking about food media. So I said, sure. And the more I watched, the more I started thinking about a new term I had heard bandied about in foodie circles, gastroporn. The idea that somehow what was going on at the Food Network was sort of a food pornography. And I investigated this. And I discovered, in fact, that when I got on the set of the Food Network, that the camera operators and the directors, they all knew this. They were all saying, here's the money shot. It's food porn. And even more than that, I recruited a partner in crime who was a porn professional. And I asked her if she would sit around with me and watch the Food Network for about 8 hours. And that's what we did. And every shot, she explained its equivalent in skin flicks, the way the, clearly nobody would mistake Julia Child for a porn star. We're talking about that piece of red meat she's handling and the way the camera caresses it, goes back and forth and in and out, the close-up, and you see it sizzling in that pan. And then, of course, now what you have is the food swoon that comes at the end of each Food Network episode, where you have these simultaneous or single moments where you eat and you melt into this orgasm on camera.
Mm. The moment of ecstasy when you put that food in your mouth and then tell the viewing audience how exquisite in fact it is.
Details magazine picked up on this after my article, and they ran a whole page of they would have a close up of a porn star's face and then a close up of a Food Network star's face. And they said, can you tell the difference?
As they're eating the first bite of pasta. Interesting.
It was impossible.
I want to ask you about another observation you make about not only specifically the Food Network, but any and all of the places on our television dial where now we can watch cooking programs. You say that it turns out that as people ogle cooking shows more and more, they cook less and less.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not necessarily devouring these programs, watching them religiously, with the intention of going into our own kitchens and doing what we're seeing done on the TV screen.
No, there's a great element of voyeurism here, and what I discovered is that the success of the Food Network has a lot to do with a male viewership. When there's a predominantly male viewership on cable television networks, you can start charging more to your advertisers. Therefore, the success of the Food Network has to do with the fact that there are all these men watching. And it turns out there are a lot of men in bars sitting around eating chips, drinking beer. They got the game on one channel, and they got Rachel Ray on the other. So it's perfect. There you are at the bar drinking your beer, and you've got perfect little wife up there on TV cooking dinner for you. So there's an element of substitution here, which is in some ways somewhat disturbing. The other idea, which is in play a little bit here, is the whole issue of our post-9/11 world. I was talking to one of the directors of the Food Network, and he was telling me that before 9/11, really still in the aftermath of Julia Child, food television programming was very educational. Since 9/11, it's become more of a comfort network, and he said watching the Food Network is like taking anti-anxiety medication. It's just like taking an Ativan. You watch it because it calms you. You're not watching it necessarily because you're going to imitate it. And, of course, this is the big lie of the Food Network. They say taste life, as though what's going on their screen is more lifelike than life itself, when, in fact, it's not at all. It's one of the greatest fakes of all time.
Let's talk for a moment about some of the fascinating history that is in your book, and so much of that history, more than anything, tells us how much we are alike with Americans of many generations before us. For instance, around this question that I think you sum up so well in saying that we are what we eat and we are also what we refuse to eat, and that from the very early history of the settling of North America, this has been part of our cultural landscape. And part of it, of course, comes down to this interesting dichotomy of, on the one hand, kind of a voracious appetite, and then others who would set up all kinds of barriers and rules about what can and cannot be eaten.
Yeah, for some reason, and maybe we can get to that reason, the stomach in this culture has always been the seat of our notion of our own purity or our own pollution. And therefore, there's always a great sense of the verboten, the forbidden, what we can't eat. And in fact, the Puritans were masters of this, and they used to use fasting and not eating as great modes of social control. They would have fast day after fast day. They would fast for everything. If Europe was doing things they didn't like with their foreign policy, they'd fast against it. When there wasn't enough to eat, they would fast against hunger. And in fact, it wasn't just those wacky Puritans and the funny hats. When we got to the Federalist period, the time of the American Revolution, all of the United Colonies were fasting. During the American Revolution, the Continental Congress would declare the first National Fast Day in 1775. When the Declaration of Independence was being written in 1776, July 4th, the lawmakers in Massachusetts were busy writing their own declaration, a fast day for Massachusetts. As it turns out, the yearly fast day in Massachusetts didn't end till the end of the 19th century. Can you imagine an entire state being prescribed a fast? It's a real political tool that's been used in this country.
Fascinating.
It seems all of a sudden this whole history of anorexia and bulimia, it's the aha moment. Well, of course, that's what it translates into on the personal level.
Right. Well, this interest in food and the withdrawal of food, or the turning away from food in sort of a purposeful manner.
It's very contemporary. Look at the people, the veganism and the vegetarianism and the insistence on pure food, the insistence on raw food. These are all different ways of saying no. I actually infiltrated one of these new raw milk covens. You know, as you know, milk is one of the most highly regulated substances in America, and milk can only be pasteurized. And if you want raw milk, you have to get it by somewhat illegal means. And it was very interesting to see these people at work and their fanaticism about raw milk and their belief in raw milk as a cure for almost everything that might ail them.
Fascinating. Let's turn the clock back to a familiar name. There's actually a number of familiar names in the pages of your book, and people that we think of. I mean, famous Americans we think of for other reasons, but who turn out to really figure fairly prominently in this arena. For instance, no one more beloved in our history than Benjamin Franklin had some very provocative things to say about food and our appetite.
Well, Benjamin Franklin said that he couldn't learn math until he changed the way he ate. He said the only way he was ever able to learn math, and we're talking ultimately about a mathematical, a scientific genius here, was by being on a vegetarian diet. And he actually had his own diet guru, a guy named Thomas Tryon, who was an English vegetarian, and Tryon wrote a book called The Way to Health. And in this, he prescribed all these bizarre, mystical elements to food and eating and not eating. And I guess it comes as no surprise that when Franklin writes his great work, you can hear the echoes of The Way to Health. His, Franklin, of course, The Way to Wealth. And the first metaphor in The Way to Wealth is money is solid pudding. You can see that Franklin is thinking about food as the money supply. He's thinking about food in terms of what it can do for his mind. He really was, in some ways, our founding foodie, and he was really obsessively focused on what he would and would not eat, and then had a moment of transformation in his life when all of a sudden he became a chow hound, and he decided, now I'm going to eat everything. I'm not going to care anymore. I'm just going to pig out. And, of course, we always see Potbelly Ben.
One of the best moments in the book, I think, in terms of just a real eye-opening sort of surprise, is when you quote his autobiography. And a moment in that autobiography when Benjamin Franklin explains the moment when he stopped being a vegetarian. And it is something which occurred at the seafront of Boston.
That's right. He was on a ship. He was doing some errands, and he was a vegetarian. And somebody brought up a nice big fish. And when they cut it open so that, to fillet it and to fry it, Benjamin Franklin was watching, and he noticed that there were littler fish inside the big fish. And so he said, well, if you can eat fish, then I can eat you. Well, that's one thing and a very interesting idea. But then Franklin, of course, genius as he is, takes it one step further, and he says, it's such a great thing that people are reasonable creatures because we can find a reason for doing anything.
Yeah, he says, so convenient a thing it is to be a reasonable creature since it enables one to find or make a reason for everything one has a mind to do.
And, of course, the mind to do is, of course, the brain and the gut controlling the brain in the head. In other words, he was hungry. He wanted to eat it. That was his gut reaction. And that was going to control his brain and the head. And this is a classic American moment.
It's probably one reason why when he writes his 13 virtues that lead to good living, the very, very first of those virtues is temperance.
Yeah, these are the commandments. These are the American 10 commandments. And the first one is about eating and not eating.
He puts that before everything else.
That's right.
As though he understands maybe more profoundly than others just the power that kind of appetite has and how that can affect even other areas of our lives as well.
Certainly, and he was prescient in that he understood that as America would expand and move across the frontier and devour the land, we would devour the resources and we would quite literally eat our way across the continent.
You talk in your book also about how the mania of diet that is around us now, a plethora of all kinds of different diets, are actually nothing particularly new. In fact, you quote a really interesting, I forget if it's a newspaper article or some kind of journal article, where a writer is sort of throwing up their hands in sort of bewilderment at all that is being written about what people should eat and not eat. And then it turns out that Marx Edgeworth Lazarus, the writer of these words, is talking about the 1830s and 1840s. He's not talking about today. I mean, we sort of know from the antique language that he's not talking about today.
They were already sick of those cabbage-headed philosophers back then.
What drove this early interest in diet?
What drove the early... Well, you know, part of it was that when people got to this country, and of course people are immigrating to this country all the time, what they discovered was a land where all previous food taboos and food customs had been completely broken and blown open. And you came to a completely new eating landscape. People were, you know, there was skunk for sale in markets in New York City. Panther steaks were still on sale in the markets of Iowa deep into the 19th century. The fish in east, you know, northeast marketplaces blew away every kind of marketplace in Europe where, of course, the waters had been fished out. You could buy porpoise and whale and snook. You could buy the birds. You could buy 20 different kinds of duck. And not only this, you had the oysters, and you had the Indians with their horsefoot stew and eating the bark off trees, and people exploring and finding completely new foods and pumpkins and strange things. Well, what are you supposed to do when you're faced with this wholly new, bizarre food landscape?
You say at one point, I think you word this beautifully, America was a vast digestive force that understood the entire continent, if not the world, as its manifest dinner.
Well, we can see it, right? We see it in our foreign policy today. I mean, we can see that we do believe, and it's part and parcel of our imperialism as Americans, is this we can eat it all. And in some ways, it kind of essentializes the American dream, which is that we can satisfy our appetites. No matter how big they are, we can satisfy them.
You tell us of a fascinating phenomenon in the early 19th century, I believe, in which for certain celebrations which would feature parades, there would often be an element in those parades, early American parades, that we find a little hard to imagine now, but that would feature butchers.
That's right.
Parading,
you know,
their wares. Tell us about that.
Well, we just had a ticker, you know, I'm in New York City, and we just had a ticker tape parade yesterday, of course, for the Super Bowl champs. Now, the ticker tape parade, of course, is an old phenomenon, the great parade down the downtown streets of New York. But before there was ticker tape, there had to be other things to use. And, of course, the first ticker tape parades, before there were ticker tapes, were fat parades. The first one I discovered was right after the passage of the Federal Constitution, in other words, the Constitution of the United States. New York celebrated the Federal Constitution by a huge fat parade, and all the butchers got on horseback, and they had floats, and they filled their floats with sheep and pigs and cattle living, and another float of them being slaughtered, and then another float of huge 10,000 pounds of meat. And they would go, and they were called fat parades, and they would go right down Broadway, and at the end there'd be a gigantic feast.
And it would be this sort of orgy of eating, and in some ways that's not so impossible for us to imagine. I mean, maybe the specifics of what you're describing seem a little exotic, but we can kind of relate to what drove people to that.
Well, absolutely. Just think about your own Super Bowl party you may have just gone to, which I personally think the Super Bowl has now eclipsed Thanksgiving as America's number one eating holiday. This is when we really eat what we want to eat, and you know what it was you consumed just a few days ago.
Right. Well, and of course, in one of the chapters of your book, you talk about these amazing eating contests, which also seem to be part of a similar sort of food frenzy. And I guess to take it back to the earlier question, the early emergence of literature on dieting would be a fairly understandable reaction to what you are describing.
There, there was so much plenty in this country. What happened is you had a split. Those who would eat everything, the origins of the competitive eaters, the people who would, you know, eat all those hard-boiled eggs for breakfast, shell and all. And on the other side, you had this obsessive worry. This is evil. This is bad. This is going to kill me. And so you have great diet gurus like a guy named William Alcott, who basically says any dish with more than two ingredients is going to kill you. You should never mash your food. And in fact, single-substance eating was a big thing in the early 19th century. There are people who would brag, I spent an entire year only eating apples, or I spent an entire year only eating crackers. And there were perfectionist communities like Fruitlands, where people would gather together and through their eating practices try to form a perfect society.
Hmm. So there's part of the face of America in all of this. The feast and the fast, you say, have always been American twins. Anorexia and obesity, binge and purge, pollution and purity. The mania of stuffing everything into our imperial system and our sober insistence on solitude, separation, and perfect self-reliance. We are a very complicated people.
Indeed.
In your book, towards the end, we just have a minute or two, of course, to touch on this, but it's an important topic, obviously, because you spend some time with it, is the idea of how we are transforming so much of the basic foodstuffs that we consume. You say at one point, our food is not what it seems. Long ago, it lost its innocence, and ever since it has been restructured, revamped, reconfigured, and reconstituted. Explain to our listeners what you're talking about here.
Well, I think just recently in the news, we've seen a lot of people being alarmed and disturbed by cloned beef. And I find it so interesting because we are food supply, and what we've been doing to our food and our transformations of our food have gone back deep into our history. What people don't realize just on the supermarket shelves today is almost every fruit and vegetable that you buy on that supermarket shelf, not only is it cloned, which it is, but it's been patented by somebody else. That apple you choose has a U.S. patent number, and it's somebody else's intellectual property. Our food, I was talking to a guy down at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, and what he's up to is he's actually creating oysters in a laboratory so to save the Chesapeake Bay. So it's not as though Frankenfood is evil. All agriculture, really in the history of agriculture for 10,000 years, what have we been doing? We've been messing with the DNA of these wild crops and domesticating them.
And for some time now.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, not just in the last year or two.
I mean, the banana, for instance, the typical dessert banana that you see, that yellow banana, the gene pool of that banana has been so constricted that a lot of people are worried that it's one virus away from extinction. And what they're trying to do is figure out how I can get some other genes into that banana so if a sickness doesn't hit them, they won't all die.
Hmm.
The end of the banana as we know it. It could be the end of the universe.
Yeah. Well, that and other provocative possibilities are in the pages of this book called A Short History of the American Stomach. It's published by Harcourt Incorporated and the author, Frederick Kaufman. Frederick Kaufman, this is just a fascinating book, and I so enjoyed reading it, and it was fun also to talk with you about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and I'm really delighted that we can have with us two staff members from the Humble Oak Folk School, Erin Houlihan and Ellie Barbeau. On Friday, a very musical program. We will be, first of all, previewing Sunday evening Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church, a wonderful event in which just about all of the Christmas portion of Handel's Messiah is performed, with the audience serving as the chorus. with orchestral accompaniment and a quartet of wonderful soloists. I'll talk with Jessica DeBoer, who is coordinating this year's Sing-Along Messiah. And in part two, Craig Gall joins us to talk about the Kenosha Pops Christmas concert, which will be coming up Saturday evening at Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage. That's a free concert Saturday evening. Today's going to be sunny and seasonal with a high of 39 degrees, clear overnight with a low of 26. Sunny tomorrow and warming to a high of 46 degrees. And Friday, actually warming to a high of 49 degrees. There is no precipitation at all in our forecast or extended forecast through next Tuesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.